that part in 2 days this week. Today is a rush through all of simple regression, and tomorrow is a rush through all of multiple, sorry, Friday, Thursday is a rush through all of multiple regression, and then we start with the serious work of morphometrics, which is how you get information off of a form in order to feed it into routines like those. In the middle of the course, when I have to be out of town for a week, I'll be handing you out a chapter on multivariate statistical theory, which almost certainly you haven't had. And there isn't any exam. It's designed to give you an introduction to covariant structures, principal components, and the things that one does with a covariance matrix. I'll be talking about that chapter for 2 days. And then chapter 5, the morphometrics, is 180 pages in the book. We'll go on the website, and we'll spend the last 5 of my days with you talking through that, a variety of different kinds of examples. So that's the general structure of my half of the course. You'll notice I didn't use the word phylogeny. That's his job. I used the word form, measurement of form, morphometrics. So, yeah, this has gone around. I hope that almost everybody who needed a copy got one. It's this document. And you all have access to the website. Then chapter 4 is the one that will be assigned over Thanksgiving. Over Halloween. I've set this up with a couple of exercises for you that are intended to get you to be used to either the ordinary morphometrics part, what's called traditional morphometrics, which is measurements of lengths and areas and stuff like that, extents. That's exercise 1. Or exercise 2, which is getting started with landmark data. And these are intended as parts of the teaching. They won't be graded, at least not by me. For both of them, I've given you a data set, which is here on the website, and I've given you a picture to try to duplicate. So for the first exercise, first exercise, your job is, given the data that this came from, to actually produce this figure. I mean that literally. Produce that figure in your own copy of R, which means you have to know some things about log transformation, you have to know some things about the BMI, the body mass index, you have to know how to read a data file, you have to know how to put regression lines on a picture. So that's the first exercise, and it's sort of written out here as exercise.bgs. It's from something called the Berkeley Growth Study, hence BGS. So that's on the website. It's exercise Fred Bookstein 1. It's optional, of course. Those of you who are starting with data that looks like measured lengths or areas might want to do this for practice in using the R tools for linear models and for graphics. Just as a quick question, has anybody had this kind of thing in a previous course in this department? Is this taught somewhere that I should know about? So there's a course in biology that teaches...
Not in biology, from biostatistics.
Biostatistics.
Yeah. Not everyone is from the same department, yeah. Although many are from biology.
Everyone except one on the class list is from biology. The other is...
Oh, but the course is in biostatistics. Yep.
Okay, so you have to take it or you can take it?
I can take it. It's
required.
It's not required.
Oh, it's optional.
It's optional.
Okay. All right, so this is then redundant with that. You should find this easy if you had it before. This is from the first part of the book, which is the thing I used to teach as Statistics 423 here, the senior statistics course on linear modeling. But somebody else is teaching that now. So that's the first exercise. And then the second exercise is sort of from the other half of the class, the other half of my syllabus, which I didn't quite get to here. MOs, biology. biotechnology.uw, bio550.2016, this Vilmon, and that's this picture, which is just a typical Procrustes scatter of a data set with 8 points on it, landmarks. This happens to be growing rats. We'll actually see the droning of it later this morning. And for this exercise, again, the assignment is just to produce that picture. And to make it easier, I've given you the actual code that does this in some window here that I have to duplicate. Excuse me a second. Well, that's there, listvil. Vilmon. Okay, so it's VI this. No, it didn't. Hold it, sorry. Oh, there we go. It's that one. Okay, that's the data set. So on the website is the data set for this, which is 18 rats times 8 images each times 8 data points. So it's a raw data file. And also, there's an extra. I didn't mean to kill that, sorry. Okay, so and also there's a text, which I know, Procrustes, of how that picture was done. Let's see, there's a proc. There we go. So there's an actual file in a language very similar to S, a language called S+, a language similar to R, that does everything that is going to be taught about how you do a Procrustes analysis, line by line. And your assignment, if you want to go in that direction, your job would be to understand how this code works. And then to apply it, not to that picture that I gave you, but to a different data set, just so that you're not just duplicating what I did, which is JHE. Okay, why can't I find it? Oh, because I haven't given you the answer. There's another data set on the website of mid-sagittal points from human skulls. It goes chimpanzee, Australopithecus, some Neanderthals, some modern humans. And the assignment will be, the exercise will be to produce that picture by modifying the code I was just showing you. So those are two exercises, both optional. One about conventional measures, if that's the direction you're going. One about geometrical measures, if that's the direction you're going. And one of my main points is both of those are parts of morphometrics. I'm certainly not claiming that what was done, starting with Carl Pearson and the anthropologists around the turn of the 20th century, I'm not claiming that that stuff is obsolete. It's only that it has been extended to a more general kind of class of data by the geometrical methods. But the sorts of questions that we ask are still the standard questions about form, function, and evolution. And the statistical methods that are used are to a great extent shared between the two thrusts here. And that's what Chapter 4 is about, the shared statistical methods for multivariate statistics, multivariate statistical structuring of a covariance analysis. Not a predictive analysis, but a structuring analysis. Principal components, principal coordinates, discriminant functions, partial least squares, the Wishart distribution. Anybody in here besides Joe and me heard of the Wishart distribution? Oh, good. Was that from a course? Just picked it up.
It was part of a model I was trying to run.
Part of a?
It was part of a multivariate random motion model I was trying to use.
Oh, okay, that's good. Somebody else had their hand up.
No, that's them. I'm a statistics.
Okay. I saw some hands flickering up over there.
Because in the statistics department, this distribution, which is the fundamental of multivariate analysis, is no longer part of any required course. It's optional. You can get a PhD in statistics without knowing anything about covariance structure, which strikes me as wrong, but that's probably why I'm not teaching in the statistics curriculum, because I don't have a say in that. Okay, what I've, so that's the first exercise for one side, and this is just a, let's see, where was that? You had, I understand, a demonstration Thursday of code in R, this is in S+, that does a one-dimensional random walk, and you either all did that, or you were urged to do it. I myself am a whole lot more interested in two-dimensional data than in one-dimensional data, because the model, which is biological Brownian motion, Brown was a botanist, right, was looking at a picture. And so this is code, it's three lines, could be done in one, that just you call it in S+, and it gives you a random walk in two dimensions, or another one, or another one, or another one. And the first thing you notice after you go through a bunch of these is that your eye, your human eye, is not equipped to make sense of this, because each of these looks like it's going somewhere. Either it starts here and finishes there, or it starts there and finishes here. I'm, of course, not telling you. Rarely it will come around in a circle. Much more often it looks like this. There are theorems which aren't particularly the subject of this course, though they're mentioned in the parts we're skipping here, that this is what you expect from a random walk in multi-dimensions, that it will end up looking meaningful, even when it is, in fact, totally meaningless. So this would have been the picture that I would have thrown up if I'd been here last Thursday.
You could say that there's only an error in one direction you can make. The thing is totally meaningless. Therefore, the only error you can make is to think it's meaningful.
Right, indeed. My point is only that Brown was looking at things that looked like this. He was looking at things wandering across a picture, not going up a graph. Graphs hadn't been invented yet. So this is something you might want to play with. It's still a three-line program. Okay. So what I'd like to do then for the rest of today, I guess I've got about an hour and 5 minutes here, is go through first a very short teaser list of the kinds of pictures that will end up being part of the imagination by which you use this stuff. That's the first maybe 10 minutes. And then, as I say, we'll whiz through chapter 2, which is actually 130 pages or something like that, which isn't being handed out, hitting the high points of simple linear models, what basically correlations of two variables alone, which is the summaries of, well, there's about 30 points here, 30 bullet points on the thing that was handed out. And if anyone doesn't have access to the, I guess the ones of you who aren't in the class, aren't enrolled for the class, don't have access to that website, if you're seriously intending to audit, tell us, one of us, Joe or me, and we'll add you to the list of people who have access to the website. It's a name-protected website. You have to be on the class list to get on it.
So people who are not registered can get on that.
By telling us that they would like to access to the website.
I was urging them to sneak data to each other.
Oh, you know, that will also work. Or Xerox this thing, which I just printed at home this morning. Okay, so given that little teaser for you, if you do this in 50 dimensions, they will always look like that. You'll always get something that looks like a parabola. This is about as typical as you will ever see for high-dimensional data. So I want to get to my book then, which is over here, and jump into chapter 1, which is about here, and just hit... this is a set of 10 figures we'll be touching on, which, taken together, cover most of the main things you want to imagine. The first one... Well, this is from a part of the book, about 4 pages, that says, here's where we're getting our ideas. Morphometrics comes from comparative anatomy, cognitive psychology, mathematics, statistics, physics, biology, and then there's some hardcore tool building inside. So it comes from a lot of different places. It is a classic interdiscipline. I'm probably more responsible than anybody else for it, since I started working on it for my dissertation in 1977, which is a long time ago now. 39 years. But it is a shameless combination of ideas from all of these fields. It isn't from inside biology, but it seems to be most relevant to biology because biology has the best models for variation. But some of the ideas came from statistics, some came from anthropology, some came from engineering, computer vision, all of those places. Did I see some hands go up a second ago? No, just reflections in my eyeglasses. Okay, so very quickly, too quickly, as I say, because we'll slow down when we get to chapters 4 and 5. From comparative anatomy comes the prior knowledge that there are homologous parts of organisms. The reason this isn't computer vision is that we know that before we start. This is a particular bone. This is a particular bone. This is parietal bone. I've genuinely forgotten the names of these. That's the sphenooccipital synchondrosis. So obviously that's the sphenoid and that's the occipital. Thank you. And all of these points have names in Latin. You can start with the images or you can start with the points. In both cases, you can do good morphometrics. But in both cases, it is very important to state with the utmost possible precision how the names from the anatomy atlas correspond to the numbers you are generating. And we'll have a whole section about that, section chapter 5.1, which is the lecture on October 18th, which I guess is 2 weeks from today. That's comparative anatomy. From cognitive psychology comes an idea they actually haven't talked about much, which is the transformation grid. They didn't talk about it much, but Albrecht Dürer did 500 years ago. Basically, this is an idea from Renaissance painting. It was available from the very dawn of representative portraiture. And my most cited paper is the paper with the formula for doing this from Point Data. This is not Darcy Thompson's kind of drawing. It isn't a guess by eye, hand and pen at what you're seeing. This is an actual drawing of a specific mathematical function that we will talk about when we get to thin plate splines, which is whenever this comes up, November 15th. So we're bouncing around in the course here to show you all the pictures at the same time. From mathematics, actual higher math, we're borrowing endlessly, including properties of derivatives, first derivatives and second derivatives. When you see back in the previous picture something that started like a square and ends up looking like that instead, that is a picture of what's called an affine derivative. There'll be formulas about that. We won't have time to go into the mathematics of the formulas, but you should know that this is a mathematical object we're going to be talking about. The thin plate spline minimizes the integrated sum of squares of the magnitudes of those, rigorously. If somebody asks you for your dissertation why you're using a thin plate spline, that would be the answer if biologically that makes reasonable sense. For processes of comparative morphology, it does. For processes of biomechanics, it doesn't. And there are alternatives to this energy term for other dissertations. But this one works pretty well for phylogeny. Properties of derivatives. We borrow all sorts of theorems of probability, which we're going to be touching on this morning in about 30 minutes. The godly qualities of the normal, the bell curve. The geometry of quadratic forms, which I had as an undergraduate and is now considered old stuff, ellipses, parabolas, hyperboloids, things in 2D and 3D. The rules of tensor algebra, which say, given two triangles, there's one pair of directions that's perpendicular in both of them, and I've drawn it here. So this is the simplest possible representation of a shape change. For three landmarks, or for the uniform part of many, this is chapter 5.3, which we'll talk about it's in here somewhere, on November 10th. The rules of matrix algebra, we do not start with those. Chapter 4 starts with the geometry of matrix algebra. there are books about this, but they're in the math library. They're not in the biology library. Theorems about function spaces, we use that for the thin plate spine. From statistics, we borrow least squares models from 1804. We borrow the covariance coefficient from about 1890, although its name isn't until 1917. We borrow the covariance matrices from Carl Pearson, 1898. We borrow the bell curve from Carl Friedrich Gauss. And this, of course, is your bell curve. But it's a whole lot easier to understand it if you take the logarithm and then you just get a parabola. The bell curve is the curve of which the logarithm is a parabola. And that will end up connecting it to least squares.
That's the log of the height.
Yeah, the log of the probability under a bell curve is a parabola. It goes down to minus infinity at both ends, so the probability goes to zero. But it's a very nice symmetric curve. And then the Wishart distribution that I was just teasing you about, and the information matrix, which is the extent to which your statistic, whatever it is, gives you information about the uncertainty of your parameters, whatever they are, in your model. And ironically, the Wishart distribution is 1928, but the information matrix is 1898. It was worked out by Carl Pearson by hand for bivariate multivariate data on a paper we'll talk about a little. You can still get it on the web. It's amazing that you can... When I was a grad student, to get papers from the 19th century, this was 40 years ago, you had to go to the library, get a key to the stacks, go into the dust, sneeze, find the 19th century journals, bring them up, Xerox them without tearing the pages, and then put them back yourself. Now you just press buttons.
Or at some universities, you had to go to the librarian and fill out a form and beg for the journal to be brought from the bomb-proof shelter
right
under a mountain somewhere. A day or so later, you'd get to see it.
Yeah, that's true. I still have a book from the dead storage library at the University of Michigan. They've just lost track of it.
Maybe you should return it.
Maybe I should return it. It's in my will. It goes back to Michigan. Okay. Then we're still in statistics here. The origins of linear models are of two sorts. One comes from physics, F equals ma, and actual mechanics, physical mechanics. The other one comes from basically a machine invented by Francis Galton that handles data that is loosely correlated, mainly for reasons of cause and effect. If that sounds to you like heredity, you got it. So there are two different origins of straight lines in our models, and one of them corresponds quite closely to biology, and the other one corresponds to biophysics. We'll see both of them. And then a technique of discriminant analysis. From physics we get... Oops, too many pages. We get the origin of the bell curve in actual molecules, which is a very close analogy to what genes are doing. So there is a connection of the bell curve to foundations of biology. Maxwell did this about 1850, Boltzmann in Vienna about 1890, so we name it after both of them. The notion of entropy, which both of these models, all of these multivariate models, maximize. They are models for maximum uncertainty. That's how the statistician thinks about them. And the fact, this is a piece of philosophy, but it is from mathematics, it is a fact that mathematics is often unreasonably effective in the natural sciences. You go out there and look at a bird or a bat, and often it is behaving in ways that are described by equations. Equations of energy, equations of evolution, equations of gas dynamics or climate change or whatever. There is a peculiar suitability of mathematics to the natural world which applies in biology. That belongs to math. That's why there's a pi in so many of our formulas, by the way. From biology, we get the notion of morphological integration. Organisms hang together or they were never alive. We get the importance of measures of extent, lengths, areas, weight, the first half of the book. and the importance of measures of proportion that summarize rates, patterns of growth, cause and effect. We get path coefficients, thank you, Sewell Wright, that talk about how much changing one variable actually alters the expected value of another one, to tie to experiment. And we get Brownian motion from Robert Brown. You remember this guy. Whoops. No, this guy. And then from morphometrics, this main part of the lectures, we get landmarks and semi-landmarks. We get points with names and stuff in between them that let you design measurement schemes and let you use covariance statistics. Before you had these, it's very hard to do anything with covariances. You get shape coordinates. We've already seen this picture before. You get ways of taking points on a form and converting them to sets of two or three variables each that let you do good multivariate statistics. And finally, you get the thin plate spline grids and their role in describing processes, either processes of motion, like this professor of dance at the University of Michigan, or processes of evolution, or processes of growth. So the thin plate spline is intended to be superimposed on top of a picture of your form.
And this picture is just not you cutting and pasting two unrelated things together.
No, this is from, you'll be getting this picture. I don't actually remember what its number is, so I can't quite flip to it. But you'll get this picture as part of chapter 5. This, so I can show you where it started. It started with Professor, I forgot his name now, it starts with this. Professor in the Vitruvian Man position, standing like this. And he did a dance for 3 minutes, and we videoed it and followed his points, and this is my favorite frame. He's off the ground, one leg is crossed over the other, and if you remove his image, you can still watch the grid dancing. We use this in a dance concert at the University of Michigan, and the dancing grid. So the grid belongs to that picture compared to the Vitruvian Man, and we will get back to that eventually. That's a collection of pictures that are useful with one additional slogan, that this is not a course about arithmetic. It's not a course about formulas. It's not a course about R. It's a course about biological understanding. And all of these techniques are basically just parlor games unless they lead you to understand something that answers a question that was originally asked using biological terms. So the answer almost never involves a number like 0.536. The answer almost always is a statement like the cause of this evolutionary process was predation, or this form appears to be adapting to the need to maximize surface volume ratio. The biological understanding is almost always in words, at least for the kind of biology I do. That is not so much a mandate for phylogenetics per se, but I come in from the more or less from the functional side of biology. I'm interested in how critters grow and live their lives. And I do start by knowing that the critter has a species, a name like Homo sapiens, but I'm quite a bit more interested myself in tying it to the other sciences of the living organism, physiology, developmental biology, evo-devo, medicine. They pay the bills. Or even agriculture, making a cow that tastes better or gets more meat. So that's chapter one, which is, of course, why I didn't distribute it to you, because we were there for 20 minutes on. The other thing, there are two more of these chapters we're just going to whip through. As I was saying a little while ago, it's because these should be part of the biology curriculum. When I was teaching this in Vienna, this was in the biology curriculum. I taught two morphometrics courses, introduction, which is this, and advanced, which is what we're going to be doing in my part here. And they were equally weighted. I can't do that because to keep up with Joe, this has to be an advanced course. You have to see enough of the morphometrics to make sense of the brilliant ways he's using it. So I have to skip over the elementary part. At least one of you has had this in biostats, which is a good place. For others, it might be motivation to grab that book. Look at it at the library, buy it, it's only $75, and learn about how this stuff, this elementary stuff, is shared with all of the other natural sciences. Anyhow, let's start again, and once again, I'll be doing this using pictures, because we don't really have much time for formulas. So here's chapter 2. In your syllabus, you can see it's starting here, chapter 2. Getting started, sorry, not the syllabus, in the table of contents. Getting started, one or two measurements only. And see, I don't want that to go off the screen, do I? So it has to look like that. If ever, I'm talking to my screen, and if ever what I'm looking at and talking about isn't up there, please tell me, because it's almost pointless for me to be teaching this computer anything. It doesn't get a degree. Okay, so we will be fairly quick. We've got about 45 minutes left here to go through something like 40 pictures in this chapter. Pictures and a couple of formulas. First thing, I'm going to assume you all know that the average is the least squares estimate of the underlying quantities. That the reason you add up all the numbers and divide by n is that when you're done, what you get has the least sum of squares around the number you're using. This is just high school algebra. People have known that since about 1600. It's amazing to think that there was a time before people knew that. So that's point number one here on the list of bullets. And we're kind of been going down this as a kind of checklist.
Here
we go.
Yeah, so
there's the bullet point, and there's the picture.
Were you going to explain that picture a little more? Or
no, because this is the course that this is the prerequisite course.
Yeah. So just my understanding of it is you're looking at the mean. You're computing a least squares fit to those 6 points on the horizontal line. The vertical parabola shows what the square of their departure from that average point is. If you shift where you're going to put the average, you'd be shifting that.
Mm-hmm.
And the one that happens to minimize that is the ordinary average.
Right. It doesn't happen to. It's actually a very important theorem. I'm moving ahead to a figure that corresponds to that here. Thank you for letting me tell you. I want to go to page 32 here. This is page 7, and I go forward 25 more pages, which gets me to 71. You get to the same picture now for the slope of the least squares line. So we'll be getting, this is now figure point, this is the sixth one, I think, fourth one. So, but just jumping ahead, the question Joe was raising, what's the best place to put the average, what's the least squares place for the average, is exactly like the question, what's the best least squares slope for a line fitting data? And the parabola is still the mathematical structure. This is the sum of squares around lines through the grand mean for every possible slope, and this is the minimum, and that's the slope of the regression line we use. So whenever you say least squares, think parabola or paraboloid. Least squares is geometry. The Greeks didn't know this because they didn't have algebra. This came in with Descartes about 1600. And I'll go back to where we were. Okay, so there's that figure. So that's a picture of variance. And we almost immediately say, oh, if we're going to be doing phylogeny, that's not what we want. We don't want all those black dots to be the same size. So we skip ahead to get the weighted average, which is the formula Joe and his formulas use all the time. In this picture, we show that it's equivalent 2 resampling. This is an algebraic statement, not a biological statement. If a measurement has a standard deviation of 1 and another one has a standard deviation of 4, it's as if there were 16 of these, 4 squared, and only one of those. And if something in between has a standard deviation of 2, it's as if there were 4 of them. We're going as the square root, the inverse square root of the precision. So the noisier something is, the smaller the corresponding sample when you pool it. So if these are your basic data, then it's as if this was 16 sample, this was 4, this was 1, that's total sample of 21, and so the average with its own standard error turns up here. These are equally spaced, so the average gives that point more weight than that. And those formulas crop up all over the place without anybody ever mentioning them again. So your basic data comes with different precisions that can be from sample size, from the measuring machines you're using, from any number of other things. And I'm turning pages here. The next figure is on page 28. And this is what regression looks like, of course. Oh, sorry. What's the rest of this section? So the ordinary average is least squares for the sum of squares around it. That minimum sum of squares divided by the sample size has a name, the variance, and it has a square root, the standard deviation. That was invented about 1870. Before that, they didn't use it. The more observations you take, the sharper the precision of the average as the inverse square root of the sample size. This was discovered in 1730. They didn't know it before that. Even Bernoulli, who published the paper on this in 1737, got it wrong in previous papers and said if you average 100 things, the precision of the average is 100 better, 100 times as good as the precision of each one. No, it's not. It's 10 times as good. So some very great mathematicians got this wrong. If you're flipping coins, which is a useful example for random walks and other things, this is the standard deviation for the frequency of heads. This was the weighted average picture we just had. And now, I didn't mean to skip over that. I haven't gotten to the picture yet. But the connection between bell curves and this sort of least squares is based on the fact that when you take logarithms, the exponent of the bell curve formula is the same square that's being used to be minimized in the formula for averages. So if your data is distributed as a bell curve around something, you don't know what the something is, then the likeliest estimate of that something is the average. And Gauss figured this out about 1805, that the bell curve corresponds to the intuitive notion of likelihood of the average. Gauss actually proved it the other way. Everybody uses averages, great idea, all the time. So error must be a bell curve, Gauss said. That doesn't actually follow, but it is what he said. And it's a simple theorem that indeed, if the average is always the likeliest answer, your error has to be a bell curve. We use it in the other direction. If the error is a bell curve, then the average is a really good idea. So that's the dots for section 2.1. And that's now, we've finished the second page of the table of contents. So let's go to section 2, lines for laws. There are 5 bullets here. And each one of them corresponds to a picture, or more, one or more pictures. So here, for instance, is a picture of how the physicist gets a regression line. The first thing to notice is that this fits the data pretty well. There is an example from biology of data that fits this well. There are a couple of examples. Sewell Wright has one that's coming up here in a few pages. And in chapter 3, our lecture for Thursday, there's examples from the study of allometry that also are almost this tight. but this is unusually tight for biology. It's not unusually tight for physics. The physicist can have correlations of 0.9999 and say, what's wrong with my machine? This is a correlation about 0.99. We're assuming it's a lawful process, a car moving at, quote, constant speed, calibrated experiment, all the rest of that. Here are the data points, and our interest is in finding the line that best fits the data because we want the slope of that line. That's an important point. The slope of the line is the parameter that we want to explain. It might be a path coefficient, for instance, or it might be that we're predicting something, the response of a crop to more fertilizer, and this is the predicted yield that we're going to use to just to borrow the money to pay for the fertilizer. And so the question that regression is best for isn't where that point is, those are just the two averages, and isn't fundamentally about the correlation. It's about this slope itself as a path coefficient or a physical constant, the speed of the car here. And then the equations that you use to get this, everybody uses them, your computer uses them, your hand calculator uses them, have a name. They're called the normal equations. And they will also have a formula that will turn up in bullet three. But, okay, you saw this already. The numerator of that formula turns out to be a quantity that will be most important starting in chapter four. It's called the covariance, and it was named by Fisher as, no, it was named by Wright as being something like a variance, in that if you're pooling groups, you pool this number together with the within group variation. The covariance is a description of the relation between two variables that isn't a regression line. It's a number. It goes into the formula for the regression line, but what it really is the signed average of the areas of those rectangles. And this is a biologically sort of strange thing to do with unless you think about it, because if this, say, is degrees and this is altitude, then the units of the covariance are degree kilometers. It has a unit which doesn't necessarily make sense. What you use the covariance for is either to get the regression line slope or to do modeling of covariance matrices, which is the subject of chapter four. So the covariance by itself is in the service of least squares, but it isn't itself a least squares quantity. It gets its own picture. This is the regression line, and you can also get the covariance from the regression line, although the formula actually takes it the other way. You get the regression line from the covariance divided by the variance of the predictor. And that probably is a formula you remember from high school, or whenever you first had statistics. The covariance itself has a standard deviation and other things like that. There's another interpretation of regression, which is kind of nice to keep in mind. A regression slope really is a weighted average. And this was worked out by Edgeworth in 1892 and is typically not part of the standard textbook treatments. But if this point is taken as known, the averages of your forms, then the regression slope is the weighted average of these slopes. The slope of the line that connects each of your observations to the average, to the centroid. And the weight is the square of that distance. And that's just a rearrangement of the formula for covariance. But it means that if you are in a situation where a path coefficient is real, then your regression slope is the weighted average of all of the different ways you might average that path coefficient. You might take the slope of the line between the top here and the bottom, or the slope of the line between each of these and the average. And if you average all of those slope estimates with the proper weights, you get your regression. So one way of explaining this to people is it's a good way of averaging multiple estimates from comparisons of different experimental conditions. And that's how the physicists 100 years ago used regression. They said, I'm using my best slope averages because the slopes are real. So a couple of examples. These are selected to be good ones because we haven't had the technology of the bad ones yet. There we go. Here's one from Sewell Wright. This is from his famous study of Leghorn chickens, the one for which he developed his kind of factor analysis, analysis of modules. This was 1922, which is a long time ago. And this is just measures of humerus length, this bone, and ulna length, this bone, but I don't have wings. It's from chicken wings of 276 Leghorn chickens. And it's a pretty good correlation. It's about 94. We'll see why later. Because it's a good correlation, it doesn't really matter which regression line you use. This one is the this lower one is the regression of the y-axis on the x-axis. This is the regression of the x-axis on the y-axis. Both of those slopes are less than 1. And their product is the square of 94. There's an outlier here that was probably a typographical error in the data set I was using. And this is just a nice example of a biological data set where the physicist's linear model, the exact fit to an equation, is strongly suggestive of the process. Probably these bones are growing according to the same morphogenetic gradient, just with different local disturbances, things going wrong with the cartilage, or the thing going wrong with the feeding schedule. You can do even better and still be doing biology. This is some data from Jeffrey West about scaling of parameters of respiration. He's modeling various parameters across, I think it's across the mammals, of respiration. The parameters go from about -1 to +1. This comes from his theory, and these are published from the books about allometry. And the regression here, the correlation is just about perfect. And also the slope is just about 1. And this is also important. Your theory might not just say one function, one measurement is a linear function of another. It might say one measurement is exactly the same as another one, except for experimental variation. So this is a this is what you should be striving for if you have a theoretical model and you want to match it to data. And Joe knows that I'm teasing him when I say this. This is how a model matches data. You won't do this well in your dissertation, but this is how good it can get if the model is in fact true. So we have tools for regressions with correlations that are nearly perfect. And you should remember that that is a possibility. If you use the standard statistics and say the p-value for this regression is something that starts with 20 zeros, you haven't said anything useful, because obviously these have to be correlated or science would not have published it. What you want to know is, what's the uncertainty of that regression slope around 1? Could that slope be 1? P-value normally published is, could the slope be 0? Ridiculous question. This slope could be 1. That was the point of the science article. Their theory could be accurately predicting all of these allometric slopes, meaning they probably got the biomechanics right. Well, that's what they said anyway. Okay. We're continuing at this ridiculous rate. That was section 2.2. If you are talking about two measurements of an organism, the usual statistical null model, which is of zero correlation, is worthless. And I've said that in print. What you want to check, what you want to use instead, is the model of potential equality. Model of, say, slope 1, perfect linear relationship, or slope known by genetic criteria, the way in Joe's book. Did you show them your book last time? You has a book, Phylogenetic Inference, I think it's called? Inferring Phylogenies, in which, in most cases, the models are probabilistic models and the data are data, and you'd like the models to fit the data. Exactly. Not to be uncorrelated, that's not interesting, but to be perfectly correlated. So when the points in a scatter plot lie close to a straight line, you get a good estimate of that slope by the normal equations, and that slope is the thing my mouse is pointing to, the ratio of covariance to variance. This will turn out to be one of the intellectual cruxes, cruces, C-R-U-C-E-S is the plural, of chapter 4, that the way the statistician models a covariance matrix is by using those numerators, the covariances. The way the biologist thinks about what is going on is by using those path coefficients, those regression slopes, those fractions. And what Carl Pearson managed to do way back in 1898 was write down the information matrix for the correlations in terms of the covariances, the covariance structure. And this was an absolute masterpiece of statistical algebra. And it was 1898. He did it by hand, including inverting 3x3 matrices with letters in them by hand. We'll get to that in chapter 4. 3 here, normal equation 4 here is that the slope is the same as a weighted average, and that the correlation, so there's 6 of them. Here's number 5. If you take both regressions, multiply the two slopes, take the square root, you get the correlation, and that's sometimes a useful number. That's what Sewell Wright was doing in the picture of his that we were just looking at. And if a regression line is an interpretable parameter, if its slope is the number you care about, like an allometric rate, then you want to have a standard deviation for the slope. And there's a very simple formula for that. So you can think of a regression as a way of measuring if what you're measuring is the slope of that line. And again, this has nothing to do with p-values. This has nothing to do with any form of null hypothesis statistical testing, which, again, if you read that book, you will realize I loathe passionately. I think it's an abomination, and I would use that word in print if my editor allowed me. It's something forced on us by the sociologists, and we don't know what the hell they're doing. Nevertheless, it's in the packages. You can soften that.
I loathe it less passionately.
Yes, right. Okay. Okay. Section 3, we're on page 4 now of the notes. We really are moving along here. Is where the bell curve comes from if you have noise, if you're not thinking about a perfect regression. And this was something that had to be discovered, and it was discovered around 1870 by Francis Galton, who also invented, literally, weather maps, the measurement of fingerprints, correlation coefficient, and unfortunately, eugenics. Not everything he did was perfect. This statement, I think, is a really useful epigraph. He wrote in 1889, "I know of scarcely anything so apt to impress the imagination as the wonderful form of cosmic order expressed as the law of frequency of error." He means the bell curve. "This would have been deified by the Greeks, made into a god, if they'd known about it." In fact, the great ancient Greeks had no idea of probability at all. They just totally missed it. They thought instead there was a god, Tyche, who made dice come out that way. They completely missed the notion of probability. Even the ancient Hebrews had probability. The Greeks did not. The Romans did not. You remember in the Bible that in the story of Jonah, the sailors threw lots to decide whose fault it was? And in the New Testament, they threw lots to decide who gets which crucifix. And Jesus got the top one. "Whenever in a large sample of chaotic elements, taken in hand and marshaled in order of their magnitude, there's an unsuspected and most beautiful form of regularity that was latent there all along." Up through the middle of the 20th century, there was a hard core of mathematical statistical theory that ended up identifying this bell curve with the notions of information in the universe, the notions of entropy, the notions of uncertainty, And all of those things are now tied together in wonderful theories and theorems, some of which came out of World War II, like Shannon information theory, others of which came from thermodynamics. So you can go further in this direction in straight physics. We'll have one example of that in one of these pictures, but there's a whole lot more. So first picture here, we're almost out of time, is this. If you flip more, you know how you get probabilities by counting heads of flipping lots of coins. Flipping 10 coins, 20 coins, 40 coins, 80 coins, 160. These curves get closer and closer to the average. We know that. What isn't as obvious but was known by 1737 is that if you take the logarithms of these curves, you get something very close to a parabola every time. And the parabola is getting steeper and also getting a little lower on the log scale. And if you put all those together, superimpose them, it works pretty well pretty quickly. These you standardize by height and by the width of the shoulders of those curves, where they go from convex to concave. And then as soon as you pile up 20 coins or more, they plot as the same curve here, and it's the bell curve. And as soon as you take the logarithms, you just get this standard parabola. Y equals minus x squared times roughly the log of 2 minus the log of 2 pi. And that discovery was the connection between least squares and bell curves, because the way you get to likelihood of a collection of data is to multiply their probabilities. There's that e to the minus x minus something squared, that when you multiply, it becomes e to the minus sum of the x minus something squared. That's minimized by the average, so the probability is maximized because there was a minus sign. All of this is in there. It's harder to do in pictures. But it also leads to another marvelous source of lines that we did not have before. What I did here in part one was lines as equations, F equals MA, or a car, the position of a car equals distance times time, S equals R times T. And there's another source, which comes from this machine, which is Francis Galton's Quincunx. This is a real machine. It's about this high. It's in his records room at the University College Library. This is his handwriting about how you use it. And before it was sealed, you use it by turning it upside down like a pinball machine. These are all little balls. They go up to the top, go into this funnel, come down here, and bounce off nails one at a time, row by row. And by the time you get to the bottom, you have the effect of having bounced off 50 nails, left or right. That's like flipping 50 coins. So you're going to get the bell curve you get from heads minus tails of 50 coins, which is this curve. That's not the question. The question is, if you landed here, how did you get there? If at row 50 you got 15 heads and 35 tails, where were you likeliest to be at row 30? And it turns out, Galton couldn't work this out, but he had a mathematician friend who could, and now we do it in one line of one ancient book. It turns out that the likeliest place to have come from at any row above is a point on the straight line connecting where you were to the top. And this is the other origin of straight lines in statistics. It was the invention of one man in 1877. So this isn't Galilean physics. This is totally different, but straight is straight. And he was proud enough of this to write a letter to his cousin George Darwin, who was also a cousin of Charles Darwin. These guys were all related, to say, here's how that works. Here's how you get the bell curves. So that's from a letter. And skipping over a few more here. This works for data, which is part of the little miracle of what we're talking about here. Galton had a buddy. He was about 20 years old, Carl Pearson, who had some data about the heights of adults and their kids. And you plot it out as a table, and it looks like this. This is from an 1877 book. And then you draw it as a graph by putting those points down on a plane and drawing the ellipse sort of between the bigger numbers and the smaller numbers. We'll see a better way of doing that in a minute. And you get something that looks remarkably like an ellipse, which means it looks like it has a remarkably simple algebra. This was all done intuitively in 1877. And then Galton turned to a friend of his, who was a mathematician, as I said, and asked, can you explain to me why the best prediction of child's height from adult height looks sort of like a straight line that hits the ellipse where the tangent is vertical? Can you explain this geometry to me, that the picture of the ellipse seems to work for this thing that we're calling now the line of regression? He even called it the line of reversion. And this turns out to be simple enough mathematics that it fits into two pages of any modern presentation. But it also worked that way historically. It was done visually first. So there's a data set. Is that the real one? Yeah, where's the real one? I'm jumping ahead, then I'll come back. Okay, page 81. So I want to go to 130 or so. There is no page 1340. Let's try that again. So shortly after, here we go. Way too far. There. Okay, so now we switch to real data from a statistician. That was Galton, who was an amateur. But this is Carl Pearson, 25 years later, doing a data analysis of 1,300 people on all sorts of measures, arm length, leg length, arm span, height, weight, parents, fathers and mothers and daughters and sons, and publishing lots and lots of these tables on 1,300 people. Here's mother's height and daughter's height. And when you draw the scatter plot, you get something that's indistinguishable from an ellipse of correlation 0.5. And now 0.5 was a number that Pearson liked. He published, he found the same value of correlation of 0.5 in physical measurements and what he called psychical measurements, measures of personality, and interpreted this wildly incorrectly. But the point was, he had understood this correctly, not as a correlation, but as the summary of predictions. For each value of mother's height, there was a predicted daughter's height from the average, and those predictions lie very close to a straight line. And that's Galton's straight line. So this notion of straight line comes from, effectively, from either heredity or joint causal processes. In the physics here, F equals ma, there is no causality. These could be planets moving around, nothing pushed them. In biology, we are always interested in causation, and we can use least squares and linear modeling with the same language to talk about causes, parent measurements causing offspring measurements. Pearson never accepted the notion of gene. We would nowadays call these genetic path coefficients. Let me go back to where we were. I think it was page 98. Catch up with the original story here. Come on. Okay, so going forward on the book, we're actually going backward in time. This is a picture that I've used to explain the following to 12-year-olds in Vienna. And I'm actually explaining it to them in English. It's even more amazing. So this is the explanation for junior high school of something that Maxwell published in 1858, the physicist Maxwell, likes Maxwell's equations, where he said, suppose we make two assumptions about, suppose there are gas molecules, which haven't been observed. They've been observed later. And suppose we make two assumptions, these two bullets, that the distribution in every direction is the same, we're ignoring gravity, and that probabilities in perpendicular directions are independent. Knowing how fast you're going north-south tells you nothing about how fast you're going east-west. Those do not sound like they have much mathematics. Nevertheless, if those are your assumptions, then it follows rigorously that speeds in every direction have to be distributed as a bell curve. And there's only one parameter. The underlying variance of the bell curve is temperature, we discovered 20 years later. So there's a physics of bell curves. This is really neat. So it's not just mathematics, and it's not just sampling, and it's not just biology. It is out there in this room and in galaxies and cosmogony and all the rest of that. And this figure is that was a figure for that proof, which is corresponds pretty much to how Maxwell spoke in his article. So the bell curve is physically real, and as a formulation for disorder, it applies to diffusion, and it applies to gene recombination and all of the other fundamental physical properties of reproduction. But it also applies to through thermodynamics to everything else an organism is doing. Anything that seems to involve physical mixing is well described by a bell curve. This is not an accident. The book then goes on to talk about, here are some pictures on diffusion. Here are some pictures about an elementary proof of here's an elementary proof of why the regression line hits the ellipse with vertical tangent. It's because before you rotated it, the regression line, the vertical tangent was at 45 degrees, and this is going to turn into the regression line. That's just geometry. We're almost done now with section 2.3, so let's review those points, those bullet points. We've got them here starting at the bottom of page 4. Yeah. So we went through the bell curve three ways. The first one was just flip more and more coins. It starts to look like the logarithm is a parabola. Second, use the quincunx, use this machine to get straight lines on these variables. That's the third one. Four, write it out as a formula, and it ends up looking like this, which we already had. And five, look in physics. We've got diffusion uses this formula. Gas dynamics uses this formula. Uncertainty of information uses this formula. It's a fundamental formula of nature. Galton guessed this. And then this is the geometry of regression. Okay. Correlation is a nice way of summarizing regression when you don't know what's causing what. I will speed up here a little bit because we've hit some of these figures before. This is Pearson's showing that the role of the regression really is to predict something. The role of the bell curve is to guarantee that that prediction is linear. But we have this lovely example from Sewell Wright. If any of you want this data set, I've got it on the computer. I can just put it on the class site. These are the famous six measures of 276 Leghorn chickens. And each of these looks like one of those ellipses. So if you have a model of pairs of rows of the quincunx, it's not such a bad model for this. These are visibly linear and visibly have differences of correlation, which are basically measures of limbs are highly correlated. Correlations with the skull are less correlated. This is the current notion of modularity. And this is still going on right here in 2016. Sewell Wright guessed it correctly 100 years ago. But to talk about this in a multivariate way, it's good to use these pictures like this to put up all the variables at the same time and show that all of those correlations are strong and linear. Or, this is not, there's no other example here, so I'll skip forward to, where am I? I've skipped forward too far. Let's see what the summary points are there. Yeah, you can get other pictures. If in a regression you have one variable high variance, another one of low variance, the regression line almost certainly goes through the ends of the ellipse, which is going to be principal components analysis. So this is going to be a tie between regression and principal components that will concern us in Chapter 4. So that picture. Summary. If you normalize your variables so that they all have the same variance, then the regressions in both directions give you the same slope. It's always something less than 1. And that's the formula for the regression, for the correlation itself. Pearson guessed here in about 1900, a theorem that wasn't proved till 1944, that if all of these regressions are linear, the data must be multivariate normal. Pearson said, I'm assuming they're multivariate normal, so all the regressions are linear. It actually is an if and only if. And it took the statisticians another half a century to prove that. Okay, that's that section. I think probably we'll skip this section. It's not that relevant to this course. Let's see, 2.5. As you see, it only has 4 bullets, so let's jump to the bullets, see if any of those make sense here. These are approximations. Oh, there's an example. Am I in the right section? Yeah. You don't have to use the data the way it came, and this turns out just to be a good general principle in biometrics. Here's the report of an experiment, half of an experiment, actually. We'll see the other half in the next chapter. An experiment growing a protist, tetrahymena, in solution with various couple of concentrations of glucose, high or low, and different concentrations of the creature. So you start with 100,000 per cubic per milliliter, or 300,000 or 500,000 per milliliter, and grow them for a while, and you get a measured average diameter. And this is your data set, and that certainly does not look like a line. But it is very common in biology for the logarithms of variables like these to lie on lines. And this isn't the reason the statistician takes the logarithm. Statisticians take logarithms to make variance homoscedastic, always the same. It's because a lot of processes give you equations that are lines after you take logs. So we do some of that in morphometrics also. Anyway, when you take the logs of this very unpromising-looking distribution, you get something that looks like a line, with the exception of one point on it that we have some text about. And it turns out that the slope of that line is fairly meaningful. The slope of that line is close to the reciprocal of an integer. And as we were... I need the text for that. Oh, it was before the picture, that's why. So we get a regression that has a slope that's printed somewhere. And instead, the way you report it is that this creature seems to be growing in such a way that the log of concentration is the minus 1/6 power of volume, or 6 times the log volume plus the log concentration is constant. The original publication didn't do that, because the original publication was just trying to predict the yield of this bioreactor. This creature is grown for the chemicals it bears for industrial farming processes. But when you can get to an integer, what I did was round off 0.54 to 1/18. It helps doing the biology. And finally, we're almost done here. There are some important exceptions to what we were just doing, which are important enough to have theories of their own. One of those, the third one, is applications to phylogeny. And that will be more or less the subject of the other half of this course, building on many of the things I'll be talking about. So the third of these three is phylogenies. The first one is growth series, and the second one, you've already seen me wave my hands about a little bit, is random walks. So growth series clearly are data that don't look like independent coin flips. You're measuring the same organism more than once. Oops, wrong. And This is a collection of pictures, all from the same study, for which the one I'm giving you in the first exercise is, I think, the best one. They measured 70 boys and 66 girls, I think, over 18 years. There are published data sets that sub-select from that, and this is ages 2, 5, and 9. Here are the boys' heights, connected up with lines. Here are the boys' weights. Some of them got fat, connected up with lines. Here are the girls' heights, girls' weights. And the point of the text here in the next few figures is that's not the way to get to understand this data. That is, however, the way the original people published it, which was 1954. They didn't have any computers yet. We can start making sense of this by taking logarithms here, because at least now we can reuse one dimension. Instead of going age across the horizontal, we just make age the sequencing along the line. So these are standard deviations now, boys versus girls. It's a little progress. We get correlation matrices that have interpretations. We can do height against weight as scatter plots. Or we can use a theory that says there's a parameter here. It's called BMI, body mass index today. Weight divided by height squared. That has something to do with human growth prediction. And even that, we can compute it, and it looks noisy, age 2, 9, and 18. Or we can make it itself a graph. These are curves of constant BMI, constant weight over height squared. Don't forget to take the logarithm. When you do that, constant BMI is a straight line. And when you plot the data like this, within age 2, within age 18, the regressions have that slope. The heavy lines here are the within age regressions. BMI is a theoretical model of the actual regression, the actual path coefficient in the data, except at age 9, because of puberty, the slope increases to about 2.4 to line up with the means here. So this, as I say, is the exercise for the first part of this, for the first half of the course, for using extents, just to produce this picture so you can get good at it. And then there's another example, growth of rat skulls, that we don't have time for, except to show those curves aren't always linear. These are growth over size standardized age of 28 different measures of the rat skull length, and some of them are linear in general size, and some of them aren't, and some of them curve upward, and some of them curve downward. There is no magic bullet here. This is going to have to be analyzed by the methods of Chapter 5. It was worth trying to do it more simply because sometimes it works out that way. Random walks you had yesterday, they are real. Here's something from Jean Parrin. Don't have it. There we go. Now, these are real random walks, real Brownian motion observed in a microscope in 1916, and they fit the equation. They have the right chi-square. And then data on phylogenies you did Thursday. And we have now finished Chapter 2. That was half of one entire course in 55 minutes. So forgive me for the speed, but that isn't our subject. I just wanted you to have seen it once in case for any of the examples or for any of your projects, you need to go back and pick up some of that. How you do an analysis of a growing proportion or a proportion with a variable coefficient like BMI. Chapter 3, which I'm going to go through on Thursday, is something like the same rate. This is linear models like covariance structures for more than two variables or more than one predictor. And it will include analysis of covariance. It will include discriminant function analysis. It will include, what else will it include? I forget. Interaction terms, all within the same roughly 45 minutes. Because I want to get to morphometrics of points. So I'm quickly reviewing what should have been in the previous course. You and your Keith, your first name?
So,
I can't do that. But you took a course in biostatistics that covers all of this, and anyone who's doing a thesis that involves multivariate analysis of any kind whether geometric or not, should somewhere take or audit such a course, or at least read a book about the standard linear foundations of all of this stuff. This was half of the standard foundations that were part of the course that wasn't required before this one. Okay, I didn't give you any time for questions. I certainly will once we get to chapters 4 and 5, but for now what I can offer is to stay around and take questions, but it is 10 of 12, so you get to go if you need to. And thank you all for coming. I'll see you Thursday morning. Anyone who wants to be added to the class list, give us your UW ID.